All right, everybody, welcome to this week's edition of Home Centered Sunstone. I'm your host, Stephen Carter. Now, this is the first of a two-part episode where we'll be looking into how the teachings of Jesus, as found in the four Gospels, showed up in the Republican and Democratic National Conventions. So this week, we'll be talking about the Republican National Convention. And next week, we'll be talking about the Democratic National Convention. I did originally try to pack both conventions into one episode, but the scheduling just didn't work out. So I got the idea for these episodes while I was reading The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Disagree About Religion and Politics, which is by Michael Haight. In one part, Haight quotes Dale Carnegie saying, "If there's any one secret of success, it lies in the ability to get the other person's point of view and see things from their angle as well as your own." And then Haight adds, "If you truly do see the other person's way deeply and intuitively, you might even find your own mind opening in response." And he talks about a few months that he spent in India doing some ethnographic research and how he went with the purpose of understanding the people that he'd be interviewing on their own terms. He writes, "I had read about the ethic of community and I'd understood it intellectually, but for the first time in my life, after a few months, I began to feel this ethic of community. I was able to step outside of my home morality." So the interesting thing is, he didn't take on the worldview of the people he was living among, but he could feel how different aspects of his being responded to that ethic. And he realized that it offered something different from his home morality. So he doesn't actually end up saying that one ethic is better than the other. Rather, by taking this community ethic that he found in India more seriously and dwelling in it in its own terms, he stretched his worldview so that it could encompass more possibilities. So with that in mind, just in case no one has noticed, it's an election season. Politics is in the air. And what this means is that we have an opportunity to see things from each other's angles and to find our own minds opening in response. So what I'm hoping is that this set of podcasts will help us do just that in a small way. So for tonight's episode, I've brought on two people that I really admire. One of them is Phil McLemore, who has influenced my spiritual life in very positive ways through his writings. And has Nathan Ivey joined us yet? Nathan Ivey hasn't joined us yet. I'm hoping that Nathan Ivey is going to be joining us. He's someone that I also admire for doing some very brave things, both politically and personally, which hopefully he'll be willing to talk about. So I admire both of these men. They have both affected me spiritually, and they're both politically conservative. And I feel really honored that they'd be willing to talk with me today. So Phil, would you be willing to introduce yourself, both in the way that I know you and in the way we're about to get to know you?
Well, my whole life has been really involved in religion and spirituality. So I was an Institute of Religion director for about 10 years. I then served as a military chaplain for 21 years. I then served as a hospice chaplain for about 8 years. And for the past 15 years, I've been heavily involved in writing, teaching, about what I call the inner path. So mystical spirituality, whether it's yoga or Christianity. So that's been the center of my life and activity, quite frankly. Oddly, we talked about this earlier, oddly I'm politically and socially conservative, maybe with a few exceptions, but not many in the spiritual world I'm cycling in have that point of view. They tend to be on the liberal side, but I'm without question deeply, deeply conservative when it comes to social issues and political issues. Just so people know, in 1980, I was actually on the staff of a political campaign for Congress. And it was my baptism into liberal, conservative, liberal politics as I worked in this campaign to try and help someone be elected to Congress out of the state of Georgia. And so I've had that that experience. Over the past 20 years, I've also ridden with police officers for about 500 hours. I've spent 500 hours riding with police officers doing their normal shift. And oddly, as white as I am, I was actually the pastor of a black Christian congregation for a year. So this stuff is not theoretical for me. I've been in all of these worlds, if that makes sense.
Okay, that's really interesting. I hadn't known that about you.
I have these little secrets.
Okay, and when Nathan joins us, I hope that we get to know a little bit more about him. I'm really excited to have him. So we read through the transcripts of the Republican National Convention during the past week, which was quite a feat. I realized about halfway through that there were four sessions and that each of them were 2.5 hours, right, which means 10 hours worth of material.
Right.
Oh boy.
I did both anyway.
Oh yeah. Actually I did both as well. So my gosh, both of us put a lot of time into seeing what was going on in these conventions. These conventions seem to me to be a distillation of the current thought of the Republican and Democrat parties. This is how they construct themselves right now. And so interacting with this is interacting as far as is possible with the public face of both of these parties. And so we're going to find out what it was that we saw as we looked into this, specifically where Jesus shows up, either in person as like someone who was mentioned, or his teachings as found in the four Gospels. So let's start this off, Phil. Okay. What did you see as you were going through this these transcripts?
Well, I focused on several things. I focused on the prayers. The prayers were interesting to me. The Democratic ones surprised me a little bit. I was surprised at the number of prayers that were done in the name of Jesus. Some were Lord, some were God, some were Holy Trinity. I was surprised at how many were in the name of Jesus. And I have to say, I am a Jesus lover. I'm a Jesus devotee.
Uh-huh.
But this is a country, and it's a country of a very broad, diverse religious experience and traditions. And so I'm always a little disturbed when top political leaders are mentioning Jesus specifically. Or, I mean, as a military chaplain for 21 years, I prayed at events, you know, military events, social events, political events. And I had the battle very early on, do I pray in the name of Jesus or not? Because, you know, theologically, that's what I'm supposed to do. But for me, Christianity it typically isn't, but it should be a universal message and teaching, even though it's in a different vocabulary in other cultures and parts of the world. So for people in power to be emphasizing Jesus, praying in the name of Jesus, to me would be discomforting if I were not a Christian, to have mm-hmm. these Christian people, particularly with exclusive truth claims, in power over me politically. So I've always been, and I decided early on as a chaplain that I was going to find a different way to end the prayer than in the name of Jesus. And we had chaplains that refused to do it and chaplains that would accommodate that. It was one of the big issues in the chaplain service. So it was on both sides. It was on the Democratic side and the Republican side. I just find mm-hmm. it somewhat insensitive to the millions and millions and millions who are Jewish or Muslim or Buddhist or Hindu. It just seems to create a bit of a division there. So I don't appreciate that, although I'm heavy into Jesus.
Right? Okay.
This is, there's a secular aspect here, and it's a country, and it's a society mm-hmm. that isn't bound by religion, so to speak. So that I typically don't like. So I was surprised to see that a number of times in.
And so it actually surprised you to see how often Jesus in name actually showed up?
Particularly on the Democratic side. I I anticipated it on the Republican side. I think there was one prayer that might not have been Christian on the Republican side.
Okay.
On the fourth night of the Democratic convention, they actually had three closing prayers.
It's true.
One was a rabbi, one was a priest, and one was a Muslim. And I'll tell you something that just, I don't have many hairs, but they stood up when I saw this. The priest, he had a prayer of what I would call essentially, he is essentially praying for what I would call Democratic talking points. And he had a nice little segment about God opening our hearts to those most in need. And then he tacked on as those most in need, the unborn child in the womb. So Here was an anti-abortion prayer by a priest, you know, at the end of night four at the Democratic convention. I don't know if somebody looked at that or not. And of course, on the Republican side, there was a tremendous amount of anti-abortion emphasis in dialogue and prayer.
That's for sure.
So for the priest to slip that in there, I thought was very, very surprising. I don't know if I can't imagine that being approved.
So this is interesting. Jesus getting, being tacked into prayers isn't necessarily a positive for you.
No, it's too, it's too exclusive. And like Mike Pence, for example, when he spoke one night and he said, I'm a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican in that order. Mm-hmm. Well, okay. You want to feel that leadership is sensitive to all of Americans, that represent all of Americans. You don't want to feel that a politician is pushing a Christian agenda if you're not, you know, Herschel Walker, for example, when he talked, he said, I'm a man of faith. And I thought, wow, that's just perfect. That sort of thing, even though I'm in line with conservatism, that sort of thing bothers me. We should be above this heavy emphasis on Christianity. I'm into emphasizing the teachings, the principles, but
yeah,
things like the language ought to be faith in God, kind of the classic principles of faith and spirituality that you find at the heart of most religions.
And so after a fashion, we were going after something that you didn't, that you weren't particularly interested in seeing in any of this, which is actually one of the reasons why my framing question was to find how the teachings of Jesus were integrated into the speeches. I was interested in how his teachings would have informed what was being brought forward as, this is our thinking, this is our platform, things like that. Did you see any of that going on?
As far as teachings.
Yeah, the teachings. I'm really interested in that.
I mean, Jesus is a power person. And I think most people who vote percentage-wise are probably Christian. So I think both parties felt the need to touch base or have a connection for Christian voters.
It seems like you're saying that on both sides, they brought Jesus forward not as someone to interact with, but someone to say, look who's on our side type of thing. We tried out Jesus, here he is. Okay, now let's get back to the politics.
I think so. I mean, I find it, to be honest, I find it really hypocritical with Democrats primarily.
I did do a word count on both of the conventions, and Jesus came up a lot more on the Republican side than he did on the Democrat side.
And again, I don't like Jesus being used for political purposes, either side.
Okay. Okay.
At least on the conservative side, I feel that those people who are professing this have a genuine Christian faith. To be honest, I don't see that on the, generally speaking, on the Democratic side among the politicians.
Ah, okay. Because I was just going to say, I'm going to have two of those people on next week. Genuinely Christian people who are Democrats. So you're just talking about leadership. Okay, we'll leave it there then. Okay.
I have a lot of Christian friends that are Democrats. If you look at a lot of what's gone on in the past several years, it's the left that's trying to get religion out of public life. That's been attacking religious organizations and minimizing their influence and so forth.
I'm really interested in steeping in your worldview, in your terms, in your world.
Okay.
So what's it like to be in the conservative worldview, so I can feel that in this Republican convention, especially with these teachings of Jesus that we were talking about?
You know, how America is seen matters. I mean, I served in the military for 21 years. I love America, period. And that came through clearly on the Republican side. And part of that loving of America, flaws included, is this idea of liberty, equality, certainly equality under the law. You know, it's taken many, many, many years to realize that for the entire population, for women, for minorities, for, you know, those who tend to be marginalized.
They talked a lot about that. They celebrated the women's vote a lot.
Yeah, the system for it is there, you see? And you can't talk about America without talking about capitalism. Now, that would be an interesting discussion sometime as to whether or not Jesus would be a capitalist or some sort of socialist. But the truth is, from my point of view, freedom and capitalism has lifted and elevated more people throughout history than any other economic system. And it seems that a system that provides more opportunity, more upward mobility, a more stable life would be in harmony with what Jesus would be pointing to. And I do have a section here on how I think Jesus would comment on today and what his advice would be. But that was all through the Republican thing. One of the speakers said that the founding of America was an event like Moses on Mount Sinai. It's that kind of event. It was almost a salvific event for America and by extension, in some cases, for the world itself, as far as encouraging freedom and liberty and so forth.
Yeah, actually, what you're saying reminds me of one of the things that I really liked about what I was reading. It was sort of a couplet that they brought up a few times, and it was equality of opportunity, not equality of outcome. And I liked those words together because certainly equality of opportunity would do a lot to help people born into poor and unstable circumstances to realize their full potential and add that to our nation. It reminds me of Jesus speaking with the woman at the well. So even though she was a Samaritan, Jews didn't interact with Samaritans, he still offered her his good news. Absolutely. He offered the gospel to like prostitutes, to lepers, to tax collectors, to centurions, even to the religious leaders.
Oppressors.
And so considering the various disparities that there are in America, providing equality of opportunity sounds huge and complex. And it seems like it would take a lot of work and a lot of thought and a lot of experimentation to see how we could actually do that. How do you actually build equality of opportunity into the lives of our people so that our nation can be stronger? To me, that's a question well worth pursuing, and I was really glad to hear it spoken with so much conviction at that convention. I'd really like to bat that around with some of my conservative friends someday. So what other teachings of Jesus did you find?
Okay, well, let me pop through here. So Matt Gaetz talked about for America to be great, the citizens need to make something of themselves. So they have substance to contribute. For me, that falls in the Christian realm. What Jesus did was, when he healed, that means he brings wholeness into a person's life. And then he empowered them, you know, rise and walk. And he's moving people forward as he brings them up, as he connects them with something deeper and greater within themselves. So to heal is to help to make a person whole and then to empower them to be people of substance so they can contribute to the society. I mean, you've got to have a great country, you've got to have enough citizens that have something to contribute. So I found that message to be in harmony with that. Oh, there was the quote from 2 Corinthians, where the Spirit of the Lord is, there's freedom. There's a quote of Isaiah 11:2, lead us, Lord, give us strategies from heaven. We need some strategies from heaven. There was the black gentleman, John Ponder. He was the man that President Trump had pardoned. And then he started a ministry to inmates. Mm-hmm. And he was kind of a Billy Graham convert. Again, I have an issue with that brand of Christianity. I appreciate a person wanting them to give their life to the Lord and give them their life to Jesus. And as a result of that, serve and uplift others, which is what this man clearly does. I just don't like the exclusiveness of this conservative type of Christianity, which came out, you know, Buttigieg in his comment, you know, is it going to be about exclusion? Is our faith going to be about exclusion or inclusion? It ought to be inclusion, quite frankly. The granddaughter of Billy Graham, the whole talk was about faith and freedom of religion. Her point was the Obama administration was hostile to freedom of religion. Trump was an advocate. Melania's comment was nice. As a nation under God, thank heavens, we need to cherish one another. Mm-hmm. That's what Jesus would do. You find a way to cherish each person. I mean, people aren't going to be able to step away from unfairness and grievance if there's not acceptance, if there's not love, if there's not some degree of cherishing. And again, for many segments of our society, we have not been very successful at that.
So what sort of things do you feel like conservatism offers to address the poor, to help bring people who were born into unstable and poor circumstances to get to this place where they can be, as you say, producers?
We absolutely have to have, we've mentioned it already, equality of opportunity, but there's got to be equality under the law too. I think there's been tremendous progress in that. The other narrative is that, you know, we're virtually every white person's a racist unless you're a Democratic politician. And that the old oppression from decades ago is still the reality. Conservatism, I see it. I want to see it more, whether it's in education, job opportunity, job training, certainly in interactions with the law. There's got to be that equality, that fairness, and justice.
So
and
does that mean that things need to change from how they are right now?
From my point of view, we're moving in that direction. Okay. We have all this issue with the police stuff now. I'm telling you, I have all this hours riding with police officers. They're not as they're being portrayed, period. Conservative ought to care about lifting every citizen so every citizen can be productive and be a producer. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And contribute their unique gifts. I mean, I really do believe every human being has something to offer. And so, yeah, we have to get people out of ignorance. We have to get people out of poverty. And they've got to feel at least an equal part in the society. I see conservatism at present working at that more successfully than liberalism, which seems to be about victimization and grievance. So that doesn't heal and it doesn't empower.
I agree with you on let's lift everybody up. I really like that freedom, equality of opportunity thing. Steep me in the conservative vision of how it is that we help those least of these from your vision.
So I was reflecting the other day, what would Jesus have to say to us? What would he be about in the, you know, the political, social culture of the day? Some things we can't apply to today, but what can we apply? So there's no question. And of course, Jesus was teaching a people who were enslaved and under a domination system. Uh-huh. That was the environment. There were three ways that the Jews dealt with the Roman occupation. Some accommodated, some were violent. It was violent rebellion. Jesus, without question, was into nonviolent resistance, which was a tremendous inspiration to Gandhi and Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King's vision was tremendous. His method was tremendous, and it had tremendous power. And I think it had tremendous power because it was in harmony with the spirit and teachings of Jesus. I don't think I need to make the case that he was for nonviolent resistance. Some people like to turn to the cleansing of the temple to support violent resistance. It's really a misinterpretation. That cleansing of the temple was really at a small location. It was symbolic to make a point that he was against the accommodation, that the temple was being used by those who wanted to accommodate the Romans. That infuriated him. If he had turned the whole temple upside down, the Roman troops would have been in there. He would have been arrested and crucified at that time. So whatever he did in there was of a limited scope, but it was to communicate a clear message that we don't accommodate injustice and slavery and so on and so forth. We should allow our religious institutions to do that. It wasn't a justification for social violence. In the context of Jesus' view, which you've already mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is great.
It was the acceptance of women, other races, the poor, mm-hmm. the marginalized, etc. What would he advise today? Obviously not violence. Number one, believe it or not, he would emphasize personal responsibility. Again, I'm back to the way his healing and wholeness, the actions of wholeness empowered people, the idea of forgiveness, the opposite of victimization and grievance. He held everyone accountable. The woman at the well, he held accountable that you brought up. He held the religious leaders accountable. He held his disciples accountable. And virtually each person he healed, you know, they're now accountable for living life in a responsible way.
And first he helped heal them of the deficiency. And then he sent them off to be accountable. The healing came first, though.
Oh, I agree.
Okay. Okay, cool.
I mean, equality is a myth as far as human beings. Human beings are not created equal. We should have equal opportunity, equality under the law. But, you know, human beings are very, very different.
Talented, it's true.
And so on and so forth. So that
And a huge part of that is a challenge to us to be able to make a society where so many different kinds of unequalness can have an opportunity to become as whole as they can be.
To contribute. And I think the parable of the talents goes there, right?
Okay.
One guy can do the 10 and the one can do the 5 and the poor little guy with the 1, he buries it. Oh, no. Have 2, make 2, right? You've contributed. Honesty, self-discipline, preparing yourself in life to be able to contribute, right? However that's done. Well, I'm going to assume people know this quote from Malcolm X. And I was alive during all of that. You know, Malcolm X's complaint was about white liberals just creating grievance and victimization in the Negro, his words, Negro culture, and that was dooming them, and that they would never get ahead until they took personal responsibility and did it themselves. And that his view was the white liberal was the biggest barrier to them being able to assume personal responsibility for their subculture and for their ability to rise up and be productive. I think the second thing Jesus would talk about is cooperation for the benefit of all in the context of this equality. So equality at the soul level, no question. For Jesus, every person was equal at the soul level. When there's been abuse such as slavery and the impact of slavery, I think part of that cooperation is making the effort to overcome the residue of that. I think that needs to be acknowledged, and I think there needs to be an effort to help hurdle over some of that weight. But again, cooperation is about empowering.
Reading is weird. It takes up your whole body. You can't walk, you have to hold a book in your hands, and you have to look at words the whole time. That's why you have me. I'm Stephen Carter, the host of the Sunstone Magazine podcast. I narrate Sunstone's best articles, essays, fiction, and poetry for you, so you can do dishes, or rock climb, or drive your Ferrari, or skydive. Whatever it is you like to do while listening to the best of Mormon thought and experience. Listen to some of our free episodes at patreon.com/sunstone. And then join the We Do Fun Stuff While Learning About Mormon Stuff Club. I'll see you there.
Okay, so let's say that that everybody agrees with the three principles that you've brought up. And I think you would find pretty wide agreement amongst the lay people who are throughout America, who are the voters, et cetera, things like that.
How you do it and how it's done in specific issues like immigration and so on.
Yeah, just in broad terms, how do we do this lifting from a conservative point of view?
Well, again, I think this, you know, the stuff that President Trump is doing as far as trying to create opportunity zones in the inner city, trying to intentionally provide areas in those communities where people can and supported, empowered, lifted. That's the kind of thing that matters. Schools, you know, we need to make sure, I mean, you know, back in the 50s, the black schools were underfunded, no question about it. Well, that's not equality of opportunity. You know, at this point, we've integrated. Why would liberals be against school choice? Why would they be against programs that can take a black child and put them in an advanced program?
I do know that most schools are supported by the tax base that's around them, which is why some schools in very poor areas are very poor schools. It's simply because they don't have resources. And then to funnel everybody to another school that has more resources, then all those resources get drained. It seems like a really difficult problem, one that you'd need a lot of people with a lot of points of view to be able to figure out. Well, and I'm assuming that is also the conservative worldview, is that a lot of people need to come together so that we can perceive as wide a swath of reality as possible, even if it diminishes your own political power. What do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. And again, I was quite amazed, not amazed isn't the right word, gratified that President Trump made an effort to provide more support for black colleges, you know what I'm saying, to make them stronger and more vibrant. That's a significant thing.
This is actually very interesting. Tell us more about the things that you think liberals would absolutely love that Donald Trump has
well,
done.
Well, they don't. It doesn't matter.
Maybe they missed it.
Because they don't love, but it seems like you should love the strengthening of black colleges, right? Well, gosh, I just saw a study the other day that the income gap between black and white was larger under the Obama-Biden administration than under Trump. You know, his ability to shrink that gap has been, I think, statistically proven. So
what else would liberals love about what Trump has done?
You know, Reagan did a similar thing. It's a sense of pride in the country, of working together. You know, there were several, like Herschel Walker was one. I've known Trump for 37 years, right? And I knew Herschel Walker. So he's essentially saying the narrative about him, particularly with race, is false. And I really do believe he cares about America first and he cares about every citizen being lifted. I see evidence of that. So, and it's in his speech, it's in policy. I didn't prepare for a policy discussion, but.
Sure, I didn't either.
It seems to me there's always been a 1%. Regardless of the culture and the economic system, there just always seems to be a 1% sitting on top. A little disturbing in some respects. But the question is, what makes a strong society is a strong middle class. If you don't have a middle class, you don't have a strong nation and a strong society. And you don't have opportunity and upward mobility for the bulk of society. Every socialistic system has the 1%. They complain about the 1%, but they have the 1%. Except this 1% never invests downward. They're a vacuum cleaner that sucks completely to the top and impoverishes society. No middle class. So right now you've got six Democratic mayors in Minnesota endorsing President Trump. Why? Because they see him supporting the middle class. They see the Democrats abandoning the middle class and instituting policies that disrupt the middle class. So we need an economic system that's going to strengthen and build the middle class. Trump seems.
And you feel like that. Trump has done that, you're saying?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All right.
I can't think of anything more important. No middle class, then you're not going to have a society. You're going to have the haves and the have-nots, and you're going to have the have-nots at some point in revolt, and you're going to have violence. And, you know, do you want a 1% where there can be a middle class and there can be a mobility, or do you want a 1% where there's just going to be a top and a bottom? And that's what socialism offers. And I don't see anything else being offered on the left other than that.
So we're heading into the last sort of 10 to 15 minutes. I'd really like to pick your brain, because you know a lot more about the New Testament and stuff than I do. What do you think would be the best way to integrate Jesus's teachings into what it is we do in our politics so that they're not exclusive and so that they're actually constructive toward the ends that you value?
Oh, man.
Let me give you an example to give you a couple minutes to think. It seems to me that the best way to integrate Jesus's teachings into politics would be to use them as questions. A lot of times we use a quote from Jesus to say, and thus this is correct. And I've actually found him to be most useful in my life when he questions something about what I feel like I already know. For example, what would it mean in a particular political situation to say, we need to turn the other cheek? That would be interesting to contemplate, right? It's not like an answer, rather it's a question. It's a way to break us out of, you know, always seeking after power. Jesus was not always seeking after power and encouraged us to not always be seeking after power. He said, turn the other cheek. And what does that bring to you? And so he's breaking our prejudged ideas. What would it mean in a particular situation to be as wise as serpents, but as harmless as doves?
Sure.
That would bring a lot of thought. What would it mean to not judge so that you're not judged in a particular situation? What sort of space does that open up so that there can be more communication? So all of these aren't answers, rather they draw out deeply constructed, deeply considered thoughts, especially because the most constructive conversations that I've ever had, especially political ones, are the ones that draw on the ideas of everybody involved in order to build something new. Because like you've been saying, our country and our culture is constantly changing, especially now. And it seems like our political discourse could actually address this mammoth change, this constant change, if we were building understandings from diverse points of view so that we could see a wider swath of reality. So instead of coming out the other end of these conversations, these Jesus fractured conversations, instead of coming out with, you know, watered down ideas that everybody can agree on, instead, we'd be bringing in more information. We'd be seeing more. So that's kind of one of my ideas, using Jesus's teachings as a way to see through fresh eyes, to help us break out of our normal patterns of thinking, to sort of address more reality.
Yeah, no, I love
what do you think?
I love the reflective questions. I'm a little discouraged at the way the political system works. It inherently.
Okay. I feel you.
Yeah. And politicians on both sides, I think once they get in power, if they had a care of serving their constituency, it often gets lost in maintaining power at any cost. I'm sad to say this, but when I was in this campaign, the man that I was promoting for the Republican candidate for Congress was honest. He wanted to serve, and you know, I supported him because of that. He wanted to make life better for everyone. But I have to admit that there were times in motivating me, he would start to describe to me what the perks are on being on a congressional staff, which he promised me once we got to Washington. You know what I'm saying? Right? I mean, already we're talking about perks, and it that's disturbing. So I'm a little worried that the actual system, political system, is inherently resistant to the sorts of things that we're talking about in terms of deep reflection on how to integrate the teachings of Jesus and really the teachings of all great religions that are in mm-hmm. harmony with that. You know, how can we come to some kind of agreement on that and use those to really bless our society?
It's like we're harnessing various horses, harnessing various powers that come from the different perspectives, from the different religions, because they all have energy behind them. How do we harness those and make our country greater by using those diverse points of view?
You know, sadly, you know, because we have conservative churches and liberal churches, in some cases they've become more political than spiritual. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, conservative churches, liberal churches, they have political agendas. I've been to some churches, particularly Unitarian churches, where literally the whole focus of their church are social causes. And they're in a state of turmoil and conflict all the time, depending on whether they're succeeding or not succeeding. And And so when we allow our religion, which should be doing what we're talking about, mm-hmm. become political within themselves, gosh, we're losing a source of strength and blessing for society in general.
In churches, you're saying that that's kind of an experimental ground where we can practice listening to each other and using the energy of the people and the diverse points of view to see a wider swath of reality, and therefore make decisions based on more information, more points of view.
But we tend not to. I mean, this battle, you know, between conservative Christians and liberal Christians, I just don't see a lot of meetings of the minds and the hearts, and let's find some areas where we can work together. Everything is so polarized now. It's just almost like civil war. My fear is we're moving towards civil war in a lot of different areas of our society. It's happening in the religions. It's happening on the streets.
And so you're saying, let's look at the microcosm and see what we can do within that microcosm in hopes that it will affect the macrocosm. What can you do in your community, in your church, in your PTA? How do you harness the various voices, the various energies, and bring them into conversation so that they build something new to answer our new realities? Is that the direction you're going? You're going somewhere else.
I would love to see that.
We're worried about losing power. We're worried about losing meaning, right?
Power and
identity. And that actually goes along really well with what you do. Because when you go into the mindfulness path, your identity is one of the things that has to go, right? And it's the most terrifying thing that happens to you is feeling your identity coming apart. And we react the same way in political circumstances as well. We say, oh my gosh, my identity is coming apart. What will be left of me?
Oh yeah, and people will fight tooth and nail to hold on to that. And you got me on the spiritual side now, but yeah, the goal here is to let go of the part of ourself that's limited, narrow, scripted, conditioned, and subject to fear, desire, governed mm-hmm. by attachments and aversions and fears and desires and needs. You know, the idea of the spiritual path is to set that identity aside, connect with God so there's a sense of wholeness and strength within, and then from that wholeness and strength, reach out, you know. Share, uplift, empower, because you feel you've been empowered by God, and that empowerment comes because this limited, narrow sense of self has been mm-hmm. set off to the side. Now, what are the chances of that happening? I mean, I would be happy to see it in the churches first. I mean, getting it into politics, I find that almost inconceivable, but because it's so difficult in religious communities.
But it sounds like what you're saying is that's where the practice happens, is practicing letting your identity come apart a little bit, feeling that fear, and then realizing that what you're actually doing is kind of becoming larger, and that this breaking apart is actually an essential part of becoming more whole. Is that what you're saying?
But you're not going to allow the breaking apart to take place if you don't have some sense that there's something, there's a treasure, there's something deeper, there's something uh-huh. more meaningful, something more significant. You might not even be fully aware of what it is, but you know, faith is you sense that, gee, if I can let some of this go, if I can reach out to another, mm-hmm. if we can together find that deeper, more meaningful source of strength, that we can draw on, then you're more likely to let the periphery go that you cling on to for identity. If you don't have something else to stand on or to build on, you are not letting even a negative, limited sense of self go, because it's all you've got.
And often, from what I've heard you say, that's something you discover once you start breaking apart. You find out, oh, that shell wasn't actually me. This thing that I found after I came apart is actually me. And that's a discovery you make after the breaking apart. Did I understand you right when you wrote that?
Yeah, I mean, it's not completely linear like that.
Okay.
But the whole idea of an inner discipline is to, you know, Jesus says, you know, when he talks about prayer, and he just wasn't talking about word prayers.
Yeah.
He's talking about deep communion with God. So go into your closet, right? Deep within, mm-hmm. as close as you can to your real spiritual nature. Shut the door, close the door to mm-hmm. what? The limited false sense of self governed by fear, desire, okay. needs. Close the door to that and open your eyes to something different, do you see? And once you begin to, once you put yourself in a position where God can unveil himself, and in that unveiling of God's nature, what happens? It's a mirror to the unveiling of your divine nature, your goodness, your beauty, your holiness within. We begin to see that reflected in his presence. See, you start to awaken to that. You realize that's within yourself. So in letting go of, you know, this, my false sense of self that's built on hundreds and hundreds of different things, once that I discover that pearl of great price deep within, then I can start to let go of these other things, because this is substantive. You see, this is meaningful. It's love, it's joy, it's peace, it's connection, it's caring. And that becomes the most powerful source for hopefully what we should be doing in society. I don't know if you know who Andrew Harvey is, a wonderful worldwide spiritual teacher. He has a concept called sacred activism. He has seen where just political social activism on its own has failed. He has seen where people just withdrawing into the cave of their heart and not engage in society has failed, right? I mean, from Jesus' point of view, if you're going to awaken to your divine nature, you don't sit in a cave for the rest of your life. You engage society to bless it with that. And so his ministry, so to speak, is called sacred activism. And so his advice is grounding yourself in a substantive awareness of your inner self, inherently good and holy and substantive. And then once you're somewhat rooted in that, engage society. Find some area that your talents or your passion can connect with to improve the world around you, socially, politically. For him, both of those parts matter, right? And he's a critic of the inner spirituality people who just live in their own little bubble. And he's critical of social activism without that base, because it turns into frustration, anger, and then ultimately violence. So you got to get those two worlds together. And I really appreciate what he does.
It actually reminds me of some of the things that I read in the Republican National Convention transcript. There were a lot of people who were talking about connection and connecting with each other, helping each other, becoming a community, and things like that. And that was actually a strong theme to me, and I felt strengthened by so many people talking about that. And it seems to me like what you're saying is maybe one of the best things that we can do, even from a conservative, and maybe especially from a conservative point of view, is to go into these situations where we're interacting with people, where we're trying to figure out how to be a community, right? And every community has difficulties, has dynamics, and we learn to work through the conflict, because we know that that is a sign of our identity starting to crack and starting to come apart, which terrifies us. And then going through that sort of death where we say, oh my gosh, everything that I thought I was, or something that I thought I was, has come apart. And now what is there? Well, what there is now you can see the person across from you, because you've let go of all that, and now there's a chance for connection and for your two energies to build something probably new together, since the situation that you're in together is new.
It takes creativity to be able to do this. And uh-huh. creativity should be enhanced by this kind of interaction with others. We're, mm-hmm. we're polarized.
We're not practiced at it yet.
it's just a battle right now, and there's not much.
Okay, so practicing. It seems like you're telling us that to make things work better, we need to practice with our communities various communities on how to encounter the conflict, feel ourselves cracking open and then dying to that particular self, and then connecting and becoming something larger, something more. This actually reminds me of something that M. Scott Peck wrote in The Different Drum. He said that the way that you come into community with a group of people is that you start out in what he called pseudo community. And that's where everybody's polite and you gloss over any conflicts, etc. And then if you're together long enough, then you start coming into conflict because people are different and people have different points of view. It just happens. So what usually happens is that people back off and they say, let's just go back to pseudo community. I don't want to go into that conflict space. There lies madness. But Peck says you have to go through that and you have to stop trying to convert each other. You have to stop trying to heal each other. What you need to do is get past the conflict to the point where you enter death, where your identity has come apart, and when you're no longer trying to make other people do what you think is right to be done. And once everybody in the group drops that, then you come into community, because none of you are trying to heal each other, none of you trying to convert each other. You're all just there as newly dead, newly alive people who are connecting with each other as purely as humans are able for as long as it lasts. What do you think? Is that a good summary of what you're after?
We're talking about a visionary ideal here. Now, listen, possible or not, we have to fight for that. We have to move toward that. It's just, that's what Jesus would do, right?
Okay.
If it's not happening, you do everything you can to try to make that happen. And, you know, that year that I spent, it is so weird. Here's a white Mormon guy coming from a church that has a history of racism, right? Being the pastor of a completely black church for a year. And I thought I would be crucified the first week. You know, a white Mormon guy is going to be our pastor. Man, it just seems inconceivable, right? Mm-hmm. I experienced more acceptance than I did in many white congregations, if that makes any sense. It didn't take us a month or 2 months to iron out any misunderstandings and differences. And all of a sudden, we're in harmony, man. We're in harmony in worship, in prayer, in activities, in ministries. And it was one of the most interesting and fabulous experiences that I have ever had. And it really started with their acceptance of me, which I didn't anticipate. You know what I'm saying? Because I was imposed on them. Boy, once I realized the depth of acceptance and love that was in that community for an outsider, right? With coming from a church with a history of racism, I loved those people so much, and they knew I loved them, and that allowed us together to do all kinds of fabulous things that whole year, in the congregation and outside the congregation, as far as outside ministries and so forth. So I've experienced it at a small degree here. It's much more complicated in a political environment and so forth, but it can happen, and when it happens, it's
magic.
Fabulous and joyful and exciting.
But there's never really a shortcut, is there?
No. There's got to be a genuine regard for the dignity of another person, an attempt to find common acceptance and understanding. People feel that, you know.
And absolutely.
If it's there, then it works. You know, the energy is unleashed. It's not there, there's suspicion and fear, and then people start to withdraw, and then patterns, right? The old patterns take over and you lose creativity. Creativity comes out of that environment of acceptance, harmony, love, dignity. Then people open up fully, right? And they share without fear, and then they work together without fear. And then once new creative things start happening, then it expands exponentially. It's possible. It's possible. But we've just got a whole bunch of people sitting on the top that are hung up on power, maintaining power virtually at any cost. And that doesn't help us down here below.
But it seems like what you're saying is that with the people that we're around, we can build that community.
Oh, yeah.
And I would actually argue it's kind of funny. My most creative endeavors that have resulted in the work that I'm most proud of has always been with people whose political views are different from mine.
Interesting.
I noticed that pattern, and I think it was because our political views were different, and we were able to make an especially creative dyad because we were able to get past those things and work together. And that's kind of what I hope we can discover, even if it's just like on a person-to-person level, or a small group level, or a church level. And so it seems to me that sort of what you've been saying is that what we're trying to do is become whole people. And in order to do that, we need to be able to see each other as having a lot of dignity and knowing that we can all be productive parts of a creative community that is doing things together, making progress, and that all of our energies are really important. And the most important thing is to be able to find how to make the connection between everybody so that our various energies can be productive. And the best way to do that is to do it in small scale with the people, like the actual person that you don't agree with, going through this process with that person, just to start with, I suppose. Maybe trying to do that in church, maybe trying to do that in the PTA or the HOA or something like that. Am I going too far, or is this basically what you're thinking?
You find, this is Andrew Harvey's thing. You look into your community, you look for an area of need, an underserved need. You find one of those areas that energizes you, that draws up your passion, and then you invest yourself in that. You see, there's so many needs out there. Gosh.
You're right.
Inexhaustible opportunities to do that sort of thing. There are areas of the country where this happens. There are areas of the country where people come together and do these sorts of things for the benefit of their community. It's not happening in national politics. And sadly, the spirit of national politics is just raining down upon mm-hmm. all of us. And I think it makes it more difficult at the local level here because we're assuming the person on the other side is the enemy.
When in fact, they're kind of our dyad. And we kind of need them, but it's scary to to be that vulnerable with them. I totally understand those feelings. I resonate with the things you've been saying, and as far as you've told me, this resonates with the conservative worldview, what we've been talking about for the past half hour.
Well, it resonates with my conservative worldview.
Okay, with yours.
Now, if I see, you know, in conservative circles, if I see verbal expressions that diminish another person or don't honor the dignity of another person or group, then that offends me and I speak. You know, I speak to those things. You know, part of the deal here is to clean your own house. You know what I'm saying? You want to work within your own house. I obviously believe that conservatism has a stronger intellectual base for doing this sort of thing.
Okay.
And that's why I'm on this side. But there's always failures in your own community, so to speak.
Certainly.
So
that's just what a community is.
Care about the principles, and I'm trying to experience this in Christ. You know, what would Jesus do if he was here? So I'm trying to live faithful to that. If it's not happening in my community, I speak to that. It's a little harder to speak to the other side because there's that kind of inherent tension. I don't know. We need to do it. I wish it could happen at every level, but we've got to at least do it in our own home, family, church, community, and so forth.
In theory,
you hope that would surface, but things have gotten so extreme now. I'm losing a bit of hope in that.
Well, you and I think have talked very well about this. I feel like we've resonated on a lot of levels, and you've inspired me to be a lot braver about encountering the people whom I disagree with and being willing to let my identity crack a little bit so that I can be partakers of their energy and not just assume that my own energy is the only energy that matters. It's kind of as if I'm saying to myself, Have you been changed by this conversation with this person yet? And if I say to myself, no, I haven't, then I'm not really in conversation with this person.
I have to tell you this. I had a close friend, black friend named Alexander Person. I mention his name because I love him, and I just hope by saying his name, he feels connection. But he spent hours and hours with me revealing to me racism I didn't see. You know what I'm saying? That a white person wouldn't maybe not see. In the media, in the press, in life, in stores. I mean, he opened that window for me. So as much as possible, I could see life from his point of view. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I saw things I had never seen before, and I would not have seen if he hadn't tutored me in that area. Those are the kinds of relationships and the kinds of productive discussions. In any case, he lifted me, enlightened me, and we've been, you know, we've just been close friends ever since we met in 1984. So yeah, we need to have these kinds of, you know, crossing over the line and learning and seeing.
Well, we did that together here today, Phil. So have a little bit of hope. This feels like a great place to end. Thanks especially for putting so much time into reading all the transcripts. God bless you for reading both transcripts. That's amazing.
I needed to see it.
And remember that next week, we're going to be bringing on Democrats, liberals, to discuss the same things that we've been discussing here. I want to take the same approach. I want to ask them the same questions. I want to hopefully come to some interesting conclusions with them the way I did with you, Phil. All right, I'm going to let us all go then. Take care, Phil.
Thank you.